Welcome to the Startup Dentist Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Trutter. After over 800 plus successful dental startups, I'm here to share everything I know about starting a profitable and purposeful dental practice with you. In each episode, we get right to the core of what it takes to launch and grow a successful dental practice. So whether you've just started researching dental startups or you've been sitting on the fence for a while, this podcast is your personal roadmap to your very own dental practice. Let's get into it. All right. Welcome back. If you're an associate and you're looking to explore the path of practice ownership and maybe you think like, I need a step and I need to call a bank. Don't do that just yet. Before you do, listen to my most recent podcast where I talk about banks and how to approach them and how to put yourself in the driver's seat so that the banks are begging you to take their loan as opposed to simply begging the banks to give you a loan and making sure that you have a strategy and a plan to even what to do with your budget. So check out that most recent episode. Today, I've got a special guest, and today's topic, I've talked about like the acquisition in the startup world. And obviously this is the Startup Dentist Podcast, but today I wanted to bring a special guest to talk about both sides of this and not so much of a, I don't have my boxing gloves to box this person. say like one path is better than the other, but I'll say this, the path of practice ownership is the best path. Grab your notebook and let's make this dream practice of yours a living and breathing reality. All right, folks, joining me today. So we're going to talk about practice acquisitions. We're going to talk about startups. We're going to talk about really practice ownership. And one of the most respected people, and I would say advocates, which is kind of a funny because the name of his firm, one of the greatest advocates I think I found out there when it comes to practice ownership and an expert of acquisitions and transitions is joining me today. He is the founder of the Dental Buyer Advocates. He's a best-selling author of How to Buy a Dental Practice, the book. He is the host of the Practice Purchase Podcast. He's been featured on numerous platforms. He's got children, wife, he's just like, oh my gosh, just a great thing and very respected in the dental industry. So joining me today is Brian Hank. So Brian, your bio is exhausting. How are you doing this morning, my friend?
We just need to talk like my max bench press and, you know, what my high school GPA was. No, that's first of all, very kind. I'm blushing because I feel like the audience really expects us to put on those boxing gloves, right? This is the Facebook comment of like, well, should I do an acquisition or should I do a startup? And yes. And it's easy to kind of debate. And anyway, maybe we can give them a little bit of that. But yeah, I'm with you. The ultimate goal here is ownership. And the ownership and why, yes, and we can get into why. So anyway, thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Brian and I have talked, especially in most recently, and really what we wanted to come together was like, we are such advocates. Both of us are advocates for practice ownership. And one of the big things that Brian and I always talk about is the fastest path of getting out of student loan debt, mm-hmm. the fastest path to becoming proud, to becoming confident, to be able to have control and freedom in your life as a dentist is to become a practice owner. So we want to talk about more from an ownership perspective, not just about like startup and acquisition and battling back and forth on this, but like there are pros and cons to all of this. So, you know, Brian, you and I were talking about like just overall, like, and by the way, but Brian has a great background, not only in transitions and guiding dentists to buying practices, but he's a certified financial planner. He's an accountant. So like, I think numbers rule his world all day long. So this is like from the top here, Brian, like talk about like practice ownership and what you see. And like, I love this because both of us are just so passionate about like practice ownership, even though it's not right for everybody, but there isn't one single path. So what are your thoughts?
Okay. So a couple data points that I see, I go out to speak at dental schools and residency programs. I even go to speak in like rooms where there are only sellers, right? Dentists in the, you know, 50s and 60s, Seattle Study Club, Chicago Dental Society, Midwinter, things like that. And the two data points that I noticed that are very consistent is I don't hear a lot of students and residents saying, Brian, I can't wait to be an employee for the rest of it. I can't wait for someone to control my schedule, my vacations, you know, which assistants I have, right? The very consistent data point I hear is, I can't wait to get out there and treat patients the way I want to treat them, work with the assistants I gel with, have the types of procedures and production. So early in their career, people are, they're not using the word control. But that's what they're talking about. Okay. Then I don't see a lot of 50, 60, 70-year-old dentists in the you know, Seattle Study Club meeting or Chicago Midwinter saying, you know what, Brian, I'm wealthy and I was an employee my whole career and I'm thrilled with it. I'm so glad that I stayed an associate for my entire career. And I'll give you a third bonus. It's even
I think people would be embarrassed to do that, actually. I don't think those people show up.
Well, and let's not – I don't want to be too judgmental. You can have a fantastic career as an employee dentist for your entire career. And there's nothing wrong with that per se. I just don't see a lot of it. And I don't – here's my third data point. And I'm curious, Stephen, if you agree. I don't have any associates that come to me and say, Brian – I love my job. I just want to get into ownership somehow. Can you help me out? It's always, oh my gosh, I can't stand my boss, my schedule, the pressure I'm getting. I want to move, something like that. No one ever says, I love the DSO I work for. And I want to now I want to go into ownership. It's always, I can't stand X, Y, and Z. Please help me out of here.
Hey there, Startup Dentist Podcast listeners. It's Stephen Trotter here, taking a quick break from today's episode to share something special with you. If you're dreaming of owning your own dental practice, then you need to get your hands on our Startup Dentist book. This isn't just any book. It's a 200-plus page comprehensive guide that covers everything you need to know to start a successful dental practice. From picking the perfect location to designing a patient-friendly office to building a marketing plan that draws in your ideal patients, we've got you covered. This book is packed with insider tips and real-world strategies. Yeah, I was just, we had a vision call with a client literally, what's today? Oh, it's a Wednesday. So 2 days ago on Monday. And he said he's working in this busy environment. His name's Dr. Justin. He's outside of DC. And he literally said, I asked him about getting here to this place of like choosing. He's starting a practice. And some, oh yeah, I forgot somebody you have spoken to as well. Yep. A common connection. Kind of odd. It was a common connection there of this doctor. Both of us I actually spoke to, and he said, working in this environment, I learned things from a perspective of like the systems, because I feel like everything is just a transaction in working for a DSO. I don't have the way that I want to treat patients in this environment. And he goes, I feel this pressure on a day-to-day basis to produce. And then the numbers go up, and it's just, it's spreadsheet dentistry, basically, which is that environment. And, you know, I've had another dentist, Dr. Jordan, I mentioned before, even in my book, talking about, he referred to himself as a McDentist, you know, like working at, like, he was like, it was a transaction. I was seeing like X amount of patients per day on roller skates. And so I agree with you. Like, no one ever says, boy, you know what? I can't wait to work forever for somebody else. Right. That's the reason why, like, they approach people like you and herself and talk about like, hey, how do I get to that next level?
So let's make sure we're honest though. As an owner, you will feel production pressure, right? Now as an owner, 100%. You're controlling the addiction to food, clothing, and shelter for a staff. You know, you're controlling whether or not someone goes home in pain, and you need to do your dentistry well. So the pressure to produce never quite goes away. It's a question of how do you want to handle that pressure? Do you want somebody else in control of that pressure, or do you want to set 100%. The dials around that pressure and how much income you want to make, what the schedule is, how many vacation days you take per year, you know, whether or not you take XYZ insurance or your fee for service or Medicaid. So the pressure never goes away, but I think let's talk.
It's a different, it's a different pressure that I always see. And so I think it's about like understanding it's not right for everybody, but for those who feel like this path of practice ownership is right for them, like this is what we're going to explain. So let's talk about this. Like, I'm going to jump in. Common misconceptions. I think a lot of people think like, or what they read or Facebook and things like that. Give me what are some common misconceptions? We'll kind of banter on this on acquisitions. Like what are things that you hear? Maybe like the top couple things that you hear that are just like completely just wrong and is misconceptions about the world of transitions and acquisitions.
Okay. The first and most common misconception about buying a practice, an existing practice, is that when you're ready, the practice that you want to buy will also be available in the place you want to live. Okay. And I think here's the understandable part of the misconception is when I'm ready to buy a house or a condo, you know, I can hop online hire a broker maybe, but there's an MLS database. There are probably houses in XYZ city that I want to live with, you know, three bedrooms and two bathrooms and a three-car garage and this square, you know. So the way people have approached big purchases in the past is they hop on a website and there's probably something for sale. And the biggest misconception is the same thing is true about a dental practice. Even if, by the way, Stephen, I'm in a huge, you know, I'm in the fifth biggest city in the country, Phoenix, Arizona, and I want to buy a practice, or I'm in Denver. I'm not talking like Dubuque, Iowa, or, you know, Rexburg, Idaho, where it's a smaller town. There's maybe, you know, 16 total dentists. We're talking cities with thousands of dentists. There's probably not going to be one on a website the day you're ready to buy a practice. That's misconception number
Absolutely.
One. What about you?
Yep. Yeah, I would say, I think misconception number one when it comes to a startup in my world is I think a lot of them think I need to go where no other dentists are located.
Yeah.
I think they automatically think like, I need to go to rural because, you know, or whatever that is, or that if I don't, and like kind of dovetails, if I just build it, like they'll automatically come. Like this is not like the field of dreams where it's like, if I build it, they'll come. So it takes a ton of work, but I also think they feel as if I need to go where no other dentists are. And yeah, there's a few people out there that will say like, go to a rural area, but some people don't want to be in a rural area within that. And it's funny when you talk about like availability. Well, the one big other thing that happens in our world from a startup perspective is the real estate is such a big challenge in our world is that the same thing. There's only so many pieces of real estate to actually start up a practice. So the same thing, they have that timeline of finding a practice to purchase isn't, okay, today's August, I'm ready to go. Hey, let's go find a practice next week. Same thing happens in our world of like the real estate. Okay, I'm ready to go find real estate. Yeah. Is it available now?
Right.
Might be built in a year from today.
Yeah.
Same thing. So,
Yeah,
absolutely.
Second misconception I'd say is that in an acquisition, that there will be massive patient attrition. I'm curious. I don't know the answer to this question. I haven't asked you. When people are talking about a startup with you, and do they mention patient attrition in an acquisition? And if yes, do they put a percentage on it? Like, well, I'm going to lose 25% of the patients, 10% of the patients, 50% of the, like, what do people say when they talk to you, if anything?
I think when it comes to not on startups, because there isn't attrition, there's just growth. But I think, you hear like information, like sometimes there is attrition. I think in the wrong acquisition, sure, I'm sure is. There naturally is going to be some sort of attrition. But I think it's not what some people think. I think it comes down to, and maybe you'll touch on this a little bit, which is what do you do when you step into that practice?
Right.
Because if you think you're just going to slide in and be like, cool, this is great. I think you got to approach our worlds of practice ownership are not that dissimilar. So if you're listening today, like folks, like it isn't, I almost say you have to approach some acquisitions like a startup, because I actually saw a post the other day, and the doctor said, I've owned a practice. I bought it 2 or 3 years ago. I lost 50%. Now that sounds bad, but the comments weren't like, and this doctor was like, oh, well, what if I picked up a couple of extra PPOs? And everyone's like, what are you doing to actually get patients through the door?
Yeah.
You can't just like acquire a practice and go sit back on your laurels and say, okay, cool, everything's going to be status quo, because that has nothing to do with attrition. That has to do with you're running a business that needs growth and new patients no matter what.
Yeah. One of the benefits, we'll get into pros and cons, startup versus acquisition. One of the benefits though of doing an acquisition is instead of buying equipment and a real estate location, what you're really buying are the habits of patients who know to come into that practice, right? And so I would say the second biggest misconception in acquisition is that there will be patient attrition. So I have some data for you, Stephen.
Love it.
11 to 1200 transitions that I've done in the last 8-9 years. I always send a survey about a year after they buy the practice, and I ask them, one of the questions is, you know, what percentage of, how many, I said, your patient base was X when you bought the practice. Do you know what it is now? And now I've gotten about a 50% response rate. So I've got a couple hundred data points here. This isn't peer reviewed. I haven't published this anywhere. So take the number with a grain of salt, but here's the actual patient attrition number for several hundred dental practices. You ready for the number?
I'm ready.
-3.1%. Meaning here's a negative patient attrition number is a double negative. That means the average buyer that I work with adds net patients in the first year of ownership.
Yes.
Okay. Now, why?
Yep.
Now, first of all, it is reasonable. Here are some the guy that lost 50%, those data points are out there. Okay. So let's acknowledge that. Number one. Number two, if there's a massive demographic miss or mismatch between buyer and seller, maybe a religious difference, could be part of the country you come from, an accent. I don't know. There's all kinds of different things. There are reasons why patients may not relate to a buyer versus a seller. That can contribute to patient attrition. But the worst number I've ever seen, 10%. It was a Hasidic Jew client bought in a relatively Muslim neighborhood in Brooklyn and just saw, you know, about a 10% patient drop. The other data point that I'll give you for acquisitions around patient attrition is there will, 100% guaranteed, there will be about 10 patients, maybe 12, maybe 8, that are very loud about missing the seller. And they're in line at the grocery store or they're on Google reviews and they're talking about the buyer and they're not as good as the seller. And the buyer hyper focuses on those 6, 8, 10 people that are very dissatisfied, forgetting the 1,400, 1,800, 2,100 active patients that love the buyer and they're coming in and telling their friends about it and everything else. So second biggest misconception is patient attrition is a problem because it's actually not a problem.
Yeah. And I would say the one of the biggest misconceptions of startups is most startups fail. Mm. And I think it's the failure rate is that much higher.
Yeah.
And the thing is, because we do hear those stories, it's not the failure. It's some of the ones that struggle. And I think a lot of them approach it as if I build this cheap, it's kind of like buying a cheap practice.
Yep.
It's like, wow, there is what I could buy a cheap practice and there's so much potential. Okay. I could build a cheap startup. And if you skimp on things that don't give you growth, marketing, things like that, you're just the cheap doctor on the corner with a cheap practice. So I think both of our worlds kind of converge within that. And that's why I always say, and I just wrote down, like, I always recommend approaching both of these from kind of the same lens, looking at who your ideal patient is, understanding the demographics in the marketplace. And I always say, don't start up just because, but just don't buy because you got to like those that practice needs align, you know, with some of your values as well. And, you know, within the right space. So
couldn't agree more. I'll give you one more misconception. We can move on if you want, but I would say a big misconception about the acquisition process is just that buying a smaller practice is easier, better, or wiser than buying a more expensive or bigger practice. And by big, I don't mean square footage. I mean collections.
Yes.
So it's actually better in most cases, better to buy the $1 million practice, pay $1 million than it is to pay $400,000. I understand the math. Like, you know, I've got two finance degrees and I took advanced valuations. I worked on Wall Street. I understand that $1 million is $600,000 more than $400,000 and the associated loan payment with that. And it's often, I would say 98% of the time, it's better to buy the more expensive practice because that practice has all the things that you just described, Stephen. It's not the cheap doctor on the corner. It has a good reputation. It has the positive, the well-trained staff. It has the patients who expect and know that they're going to have a professional dentist. Anyway, so misconception.
Yeah, I think I always say it's you're swimming up. You're like a salmon, salmon are equipped to swim. I'm not a fisherman by any means, but salmon are equipped to swim upstream.
Yeah.
Practice owners aren't. And I think there's always like somebody had a set story. There's always like one doctor that says, I did buy that practice for $250,000 and I turned it into, there's also the dentist that also says, I built my first startup for $200,000. Okay. It's the same misconceptions. Like it's both of those. If you're going to buy a $300,000 practice, and most people say, well, I could buy this practice for the cheap, but my startup's going to cost more.
Yeah.
I would say, well, you really need to look at that from a broad picture because it's not as simple as some people think to battle against maybe a bad reputation, battle against patients may have been, because from a former banker's perspective, what the banks are looking for in those acquisitions, the declining revenues is where's the bottom? Where does the bottom hit before you can say, hey, how do I grow that? Mm-hmm. And I'm with you. I think you got to buy a practice that has the production, has the systems in place in order to toss that off.
Yeah.
So,
I love it. Totally agree.
Pros and cons. I think I've talked a lot about that. Is there just like a couple, just like,
for the audience. I'll tell you what I tell people that are saying, hey, Brian, should I do a startup or an acquisition? First, my first answer, by the way, is yes. Right. I mean, think about the ultimate goal. What is your ultimate goal? If it's to get into ownership, then pick a path, okay?
Yep.
I'll say the biggest, two biggest cons that I see with a startup on the startup podcast. Okay. So you can kick me off. No,
come on.
two biggest cons is cost. And I'll explain what I mean by cost, cause I don't mean money. Okay. But cost. Yep. And then, I'll call it hubris. Okay. So cost and hubris. Yes. And I'll explain what I mean by those. All right. Two biggest cons that I see to startups. And by the way, I want you to give me the biggest cons of acquisitions too. And then if I feel the need, I can defend them, but I probably don't feel the need. A lot of dentists assume that the biggest cost of doing a startup is the sticker value of whatever loan they're going to go get from B of A. Okay. Or whichever bank. Okay. Provide yeah. whoever. That is not true. Your biggest cost of doing a startup is your time. Okay. Now here's why. The time that you're going to spend to get the doors open in a dump, Steven, I would say 12 to 18 months. Okay. If I called you up and said, I want to start up a practice in Draper, Utah, which is where I live. And there are like 22 GPs in like a 2 mile radius of me, but I'm the guy, I'm going to start number 23. I've got 18 months before doors are even open. Okay? And then the average, when I was doing taxes and doing more financial planning for dentists than I'm doing today, I saw it as about 2 to 3 years from doors open to sustainable patient base. That was kind of the average for the average startup dentist who didn't use a good team and kind of just kind of opened the doors.
That's right.
So that's right. I'm looking at 3.5 to 4 years of time to where I'm at a kind of a sustainable patient base level. And I'm looking at it as the acquisition guy and saying, all right, in 4 years, you can find a great practice, buy it, and have a substantial portion of that loan paid off. And by the way, the money you would have made as an acquisition owner and the time, all the learning you would have had as the owner of that practice is worth a lot. And so the biggest cost is the time value of, it's the opportunity cost of what you lost by taking 4 years to get to a sustainable patient base that you could have bought 4 years ago. So that's my yes. biggest, you know, I'll stop there with cost. We can talk about hubris in a second, but what do you think? And give me your rebuttal on that.
I think anybody that tries to do it from a DIY perspective, and I think that's where I go to, is anybody that tries to do it, and I talk about this all the time, I think, and this is probably going to rain on a little bit of the parade of the hubris, which is I'm going to do it myself, and I'm going to trudge through this for 2 or 3 years, and I'm going to feel better about it. Why?
Right.
Why wouldn't you just, why can't you find a cheat code to be able to grow a startup that much faster? I think this whole idea of like, if I DIY it, I'm going to feel better about it in 2 or 3 years. No, you just struggle for 2 or 3 years, but your doors are open, but you continue to work as an associate 2 or 3 years into your startup. That to me is a, it's not a failure, but it's a failure. It's not a failure of they have gone out of business. It's a failure because there's a better, faster path. And part of it is, they, with a startup, a lot of times they chase the practice. And I talk about like practice profits and purpose. And they just, most doctors chase practice. And what they do is they go, I found four walls and I got a loan and I got chairs. Yes, you have a practice, but then how do you grow it? And I think having systems and the right people to help grow it can definitely, it makes that curve. Our practice owners break even like 3 to 6 months, like very, very quickly. They're out of their associate position within 6 months, like on average. So there's a faster path that exists out there. And I think this idea, maybe a little bit of the hubris that also comes into play, which is if I do it myself, it will feel better. But think about some of the greatest sports stars, the celebrities and everybody. I talk about this, like they all have coaches. They have a dietitian. Yeah. They've got like this coach. They got that coach, a strength coach, swing coach, whatever it is. Why do they have coaches? Because somebody else is an expert in their field and they can look above and say, hey, I see things happening before it happens. Just like in your world, they can go in. I see people all the time post buying a practice and they go, hey, here's all the details. What does everybody think? It doesn't matter what everybody thinks.
Yeah.
No one cares. Like when people post their floor plans about, hey, here's my startup floor plan. 65 comments don't matter to your vision. And if you're getting legal or accounting advice or purchase advice on Facebook, stop doing it, please.
Well, yeah, I totally agree. So I'll agree with your story by saying, so Steven, the 2 years that I paid $9.99 a month for my gym membership and I struggled and I didn't see results. And then I switched over to a different gym. It's kind of a group fitness class. You show up, it's all planned for you. But that gym was $180 a month, okay, a lot more expensive. Yeah. And lo and behold, you know, in the, you know, months after I started the new gym, I started seeing some physical results. Are you saying that that's like, you know, the do-it-yourself mentality? It sounds like you are.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's that's the way what to avoid. I think one of the cons I always hear about acquisitions and it's like more from a bigger picture is they are acquiring in a lot of cases, somebody else's vision. And I think for a lot of people, and again, this is just like, you know, what's out there. I think some people are looking for that element. And I think there's a little bit of a science that needs to go into like looking at that. And some doctors don't want to acquire. I had a doctor a few years ago. It took him a long story short. I asked him when I told him I wouldn't talk people into a startup after my speech, he said, talk me into a startup. And I said, how long have you owned your first practice? He goes, 6 years. He said, okay. I said, how long did it take you to fully implement your team, your systems and everything inside of this practice while the two other former owners stayed on board? He looked at me kind of sheepishly and said, it took me 5 years.
Yeah.
Some people, but again, he had like the infrastructure, but like for him, it was like, you know,
and so the sellers,
again, you have to measure. You got to measure those.
I agree with you. And you know, so in the acquisition world, I mentioned one of the misconceptions is a practice will be available when I want to buy it. I will agree with your major con of an acquisition is an additional layer on top of that is a practice is available when I want to buy it and the seller has a similar enough practice philosophy, number of operators, trained staff that is close enough to my vision that I'm gonna be able to step in. And it can be a tall order. And so I totally agree.
You don't need 100%, but you can't be 100%. It's never going to be 100%.
75 to 80.
You just need to exactly.
Yep, exactly.
Any big things in your world that you would say avoid? Mm-hmm. I'll pick up two of your deal killers when it comes to acquisitions.
Yeah. Okay. We just talked about number one, philosophy disconnect. Okay. Yep. Seller, the watch and wait, buyer's going to come in and put 4 crowns on everything in every single patient's mouth. The staff and the patients are going to feel whipsawed. They're going to mistrust the buyer, and that buyer's not going to do very well. So philosophy mismatch would be number one. And then, you know, number two would be, actually, I'll touch on the hubris comment because this relates to kind of what I see is I can buy a cheaper practice or I can find a practice I don't need to invest in. That if I'm paying a sticker price for a practice, I don't need to buy new chairs, new equipment. All the imaging stuff will be perfect and exactly what I want. And that's just not the case either. So deal killer, assuming that the seller has to have your perfect practice all set up for you. That's just, you know, either you're going to do a startup and you're going to invest some money in setting up the chairs and equipment the way you want it, or you're going to buy somebody else's practice, live with it for a little while, but you're going to have to invest in new equipment, new chairs, new paints on the wall, regardless. And so, you know, I think that's just a mindset thing that a lot of buyers need to focus on and hopefully have a good team to help them. Yeah.
And I think the hubris also comes into, I'm the new doctor. The old doctor wasn't as good.
Yeah.
And I can make changes because the patients will like me more. Maybe the doctor, I've heard this, but you know, like maybe the doctor was just like, not a nice guy.
Sure.
Not a nice person.
Yeah.
And it's like some people just, the team has accepted that. And I think going in thinking, making dramatic, radical changes to a practice is like, I would say, don't do that. I would never do that. I would never say go in from day one and make radical changes to a practice if you buy it because you think your way is going to be dramatically better. I think then you can get some mutiny on your hands. You know?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, you know, when it comes to your team, stuff like that. So
yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I think there's just, again, for this world, I always say, let's talk about like some next steps. I always say explore both paths. Like we have shared clients. We have shared like people that have kind of bounced back and forth from our worlds. I always say, number one is for everyone's listen, this is not about like, Steven's right, Brian's wrong, or vice versa. This is not about one path is better than the other. One path will be better for you, depending on the time, but depending on it. But I would say explore both paths. What do you say about that, Brian?
Yeah, go for it. Exactly. And I think to get even more tangible, so I'll agree and then just say, here's how I would explore both paths. Is I would create as robust a network of dentists, hopefully with some gray hair on their heads, in the area or cities where you think you might want to practice for your career. Okay. Now, yes, that network of folks is going to do a couple things for you. You're going to be able to ask them about the neighborhoods, the areas. Where do you see growth? Where do you not see growth? Where's kind of, you know, the bad area of town to avoid maybe? Yeah. Which practices have a good reputation and don't? And you're going to find out, it's going to help you kind of land on, do I do the startup? Do I do the acquisition? If I do the acquisition, which areas of town? If I do the startup, you know, do I want to go to the exurbs where the growth is going to be in the new junior high that has all the you know, the students that need phase one and phase two with orthodontics, you know, all of those questions. But if you try to do it yourself, or gosh, I mean, you touched on this a little bit, if you just try to sit in your pajamas on Dental Town and the Facebook groups and just kind of do it online, it's never going to work. So you got to get out. You got to have coffees. You got to take people to lunch.
Yes.
How, you know, if you're a 57-year-old dentist, you've got about 5-10 years left in your career, and a 32-year-old gunner comes to you and says, "Hey, Dr. Trutter, I can't believe how amazing your practice is. Can I buy your lunch and ask you about how you've been so successful?" Oh my gosh, like your head would explode from how big you feel and how awesome you feel. Those are the types of conversations you need to have. So pick a path.
By the way, I'm not 57.
Yeah, sorry.
Or everybody next year. So.
And I think I have more gray hair than you do, which is, yeah. Anyway, but, which means you manage your business better than I do with all the stress. Anyway.
I love it. I'm with you. They need to be networking. They need to be in their community. They need to be connecting, really exploring both those paths. Mm-hmm. I always say this, set a calendar for your vision.
Love
Define that. When you want to become a practice owner. I think there could be life things. If you are having a family, there could be all these different elements. But ultimately, I always say you need to define a calendar and set a calendar when, if you don't find a practice, do you go to startup route? If whatever it is, like whatever that path that exists, for those who are listening, you need to set a calendar in your life. And it can't just be approach it in 30 days and go, okay, go.
Yeah.
There needs to be a lot of pre-planning because we'll talk about finances here in a moment. Like that calendar has a lot of things we need to build into that calendar. Mm-hmm. And I love what you said earlier. Okay, cool. I want to go find practices. Can I find one in 30 days? It may take.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Right.
But it could take 2 years.
Yeah.
It could take 2 years to open up a startup. It could be, listen, I've had clients that it took 3 or 4 years to open up a startup. Mm-hmm. Part of it was, I pick on Dr. Ben. If Ben, if you're listening, he had a move. He moved from like the Pacific Northwest to the East Coast in the middle of his startup. He stopped and he said, "I don't want to be here." And I was like, "Oh, cool. Like, are we going to move like 30 minutes away?" He's like, "No, I'm moving like across the country because life was changing for he and his family." Mm-hmm. So set a calendar for when you want to, and understand, build in, I would say, a couple of years of that timeline in some cases, because if it's a startup, it is going to take 12, 18 months or more. For an acquisition, maybe you find something in 30 days in that marketplace, but it could take a year of talking to people like yourself and other people within a community.
Yep. Average buyer I talk to, from the moment they kind of wake up, head off the pillow and decide, okay, I'm going to try to find something to buy, I'd say average is somewhere between 30 and 90 days to at least have an option that they're considering seriously. Doesn't mean they buy that option and they maybe pass on that first one and they keep looking. But yeah, somewhere between 30 and 90 days is kind of a typical time frame. Now, pretty wide standard deviation around my median there. But you know, if people are looking for a data point, there's one.
Yep, absolutely. Finances. I think everyone needs to understand their finances. And I literally just talked about this in my most recent podcast about approaching lenders and approaching banks. Yeah. But they need to get their finance in line. You know, banks are going to require 5 to 10% of your startup or 5 to 10% of your acquisition, generally speaking.
Yep.
I'm a big fan of like holding off on your student loans and ripping down that debt fast. Don't do it because I always say it's like a bad gang that I have never been in a gang because if you looked at me, I've never been in a gang. But what I heard was it's like a gang that once you're out of like these IBR and pay and repay and these different programs, you can't refinance back into those. So once you refinance out of those, it's hard to get back in to that gang. And now all of a sudden you've elevated your cash flow on a monthly basis. You've got a CFP, you've got the background that. We talk about, you probably talk finances a lot with your clients.
Yeah. Here's a certified financial planner, me telling you, I understand the emotional desire to pay down those student loans. And what I want you to do first is save $50,000 in cash. Okay. You can put it in a high yield savings account. Don't put it in the stock market, but if you want to put it in something that gains you a little bit of interest, go for it. Then after your 50K, go aggressively pay those student loans down to your heart's content. Oh, side note, by the way, that's a little political. I don't mean it to be, but if you think you're going to get student loan forgiveness as a dentist, you're smoking crack. That's just me. I could be wrong, and I hope I am wrong for some of you dentists out there. But so save that 50K cash. Then, you know, call up Steven, call up me, talk to you. And then, by the way, the banks, their very first question is, do you have a practice? Do you have a location? If the answer is no, they're going to be friendly. They're going to talk to you. But what Steven's talking about is, in order to get the banks to compete for your business, you got to be actually looking at an opportunity, whether it's a startup or an acquisition. And so go find the practice, go find the startup first, then go talk to the banks. And Steven, we could have a whole separate discussion around the right banker and how that's all equally as important as the right bank and all of that. But that's a side discussion someday.
Yeah, and that could kill either path with the wrong bank. So the pitfall of either one of our paths is wrong lender
and wrong banker solution. At that bank, right? If let's pick on B of A, your former employer, right, Steven? Somebody usually worked for B of A. Yeah, so 83, I think, salespeople out in the country, they're doing startups or acquisitions and lending and trying to find buyers and startup folks. Someone on that list is number one in the country. Okay. Someone on that list is the top banker, and someone on that list is number 83 and about to be fired. And so you want to make sure you call at least, you know, numbers 1 through 10 and maybe not number 83 and call the right bank and that has the right policies and everything else. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. One thing I always say, this is kind of like a good segue into kind of the final topic is on this particular, is surround yourself. I always say this, surround yourself who's done this hundreds of times.
Yeah.
Facebook is full of those who maybe have done it once, maybe have done it never. And it could be, I call this my book. I talk about this. We've all heard this saying, the peanut gallery. Mm. It's well-intentioned.
Sure.
Some of it is well-intentioned. But it may not be directed at you. So have the right team of people that you can trust.
Yeah.
I think in the world of acquisitions, I'll pick on that for a moment because you're a buyer's advocate. Mm-hmm. So for everybody that's listening, like a buyer's advocate is different than somebody who's like, I'm trying to sell you a practice and I'm a broker selling you a practice. That's a one-sided conversation.
Right.
I think in dual representation doesn't exist. It'd be really difficult. So I think selling who's representing you? Who's going to gain the most out of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think when it comes to startups, it's the same thing is, wow, everyone seems really, really nice. Yes, because they're trying to potentially sell you something. It's who is really advocating for you, who's protecting you in that space. Facebook, awesome. Groups, great. I think there's ways to surround yourself with people, but really surround them with people that have done this hundreds of times. You've done how many transitions? You said 1,100?
Yep.
Okay, yeah. I've been a part of close to 1,000 startups, but probably 900.
Nice.
Okay, so we've seen a couple things. Mm-hmm. And outside of the ones we never worked on. So we've thousands of examples. So I'm not just saying call Brian and Steven, but I am. No, I'm not. Surround yourself with like the right team.
Right. Whether it's us or someone like us. And by the way, so on an acquisition, our fee for our firm is going to be between $5,000 and $13,000, depending on which package you pick. Steven, yours is a higher sticker price, but there's a lot more included in that for either of us. And I think do you guys have a lawyer internally?
No, we do not.
Okay. Yeah.
No. We have a number of
lawyer, good lawyer is going to charge somewhere in that same, you know, $8,000 to $12,000 range, give or take on an acquisition. You can tell me what it is on a startup, but so you're looking at, you know,
3 to 8, 50.
Yeah. Well, so all in, you're looking at tens of thousands of dollars to have a good team around
That's
you.
Right.
Okay. Now to Steven's point, and this is how I feel. Tell me if you agree, Steven. The people that are looking after your interests are those you are paying directly. If you're writing a check to that person, they have your interests in mind. Tell me if you agree with this. Of all of the people we've listed, I always tell people, hey, if you can only afford me or you can afford an attorney, but you have to pick one, you go for the attorney every single time. Don't even hesitate. 100%. Like attorney all day long, then pick one of us. And anyway, so agree.
I have three attorneys.
Yeah.
Well, I have three attorneys personally.
Yeah.
That handle different parts of my business.
100%.
And it's funny. I have a, that's a brilliant segue, but legal, from a legal perspective, you can either spend people in our world of startups. It's boy, that attorney feels like it's going to be expensive. You can spend 10,000, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 today, or you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars tomorrow when you sign the bad lease or purchase the wrong space or have these issues. Your choice. Make your choice.
It's
so I think it's also the same world of like as an associate, and that's a different topic of like attorney is 100% worth their weight in gold, 100%. Especially in both of our worlds, especially on acquisitions, because they need to have an ironclad agreement.
And same 100%. Principle, right? I got a 17-year-old, a senior in high school this year. We were in with the GP just doing his normal cleaning, and GP said, "Hey, it's about time for wisdom teeth." You know, that's about that time. Crap. Thanks for reminding me. GP says, you know, we can do that for you. And my first thought was, okay. And I don't know if the, I don't know if we'll be back to this GP or not, but my question was, how many extractions did you do last year or you know, in the last month? And I got the, I think we did like 3 or 4. And of course, I was just like, well, why aren't you referring me to an oral surgeon? Like, hello.
They're pretty good. They're pretty good. We're pretty good. We're pretty good at extractions.
Well, in the same, I think the same is true of like your local attorney that handled like two dental transitions in the last 5 years, you know, your local CPA that had a dentist one time do a startup. So the local CPA can pretty much help you out. Same deal. Like if I'm going to go do the oral surgeon because they do hundreds of extractions on teenagers and they're, why wouldn't I go pick the dental CPA, me, that does, or, you know, somebody like me that does acquisitions all day, or Steven and his team that do startups all day. Like it's just, in my mind, it's a no-brainer. Dentists do it all day long with themselves. Why wouldn't you do it with an acquisition or a startup? It's a question that I have.
Lovely. Yeah. We'll end it there.
Okay.
Love it. Hey, Brian, tell everybody, where can people find you and the best place to find you and give you some resources if you would?
Yeah. Most people go to the book first. So go to Amazon, type in how to buy a dental practice. You'll see a big red book that pops up. You can get it there. Awesome. Dentalbuyeradvocates.com. So Dental Buyer Advocates. And then there's the Practice Purchase Podcast. We do seasons kind of like you, Stephen, where we tackle different topics. And so it's bingeable. And you don't have to feel like you're committing to a podcast for the rest of his existence. But yeah.
Love it. Love it. All right, everybody. Brian, thank you for being here. Everybody, that is a wrap. Don't forget to check the show notes for any links and resources that we talked about today. There wasn't any battling. There wasn't any.
No, I feel bad. There was no, next time we'll argue more.
We'll try to argue more. I was looking for boxing gloves, but I don't box. So there was no boxing gloves. But I hope everyone understands, got some great both sides of this table. Next time, Brian was like, kind of like, maybe he had like some, maybe crystal ball. I said, next time we're going to dive into the legal strategies of a startup and what the heck is going on with non-competes in America. So I've got a legal expert that's going to join us on my next podcast. So I'll see you there. As we wrap up this episode, take a moment to picture yourself a year from now. Are you still in your associateship? Are you rocking it at your own dental practice, creating beautiful smiles and making a real difference? If that's the dream, it's time to chase it. Before we split, make sure to hit subscribe, drop a review, and give us your rating. It helps us keep bringing you the good stuff that you're into. Until we meet again, keep taking that next step towards your future practice. Here's to investing in your dreams and making them a reality.